This storm was the mother storm. It changed the whole island, and it changed every single person in it.
The people help each other. And for me, Maria, it's the most beautiful lesson is we trust in us.
So what I saw a year before and thought about, it's still happening.
The identity has been very wobbly.
Maria, it was destructive, but also it was a blessing.
People are tend to live now more in tune of what they what we have in Puerto Rico.
You're gonna do the anniversary of Maria. It should be the un-anniversary.
Very, that's enough.
But this hurricane, this monster, unified us.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this week I'm in Puerto Rico. Thursday marks 1 year since Hurricane Maria made landfall on the island. All week, we'll be talking to Puerto Ricans about the aftermath of the storm and the social, economic, and cultural impact Maria has had on the island and on what it means to be Puerto Rican. Back in New York, Sarah Gonzalez from NPR's Planet Money podcast is helping us this week. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Tanzina. I'm so glad you're down in Puerto Rico following the recovery, and I'm happy to be guest hosting while you're down there bringing us these voices. So tell us what you have planned for us this week.
So we started out, you know, with this idea of wanting to report on identity and how Puerto Rican identity had shifted and changed. Obviously, it's a multi-layered thing given our relationship with the United States. What we're finding as we're down here is that identity is important, but most people are wanting to talk about the stories of resilience, right? How they themselves banded together when they knew they really had no other choice, when they realized that the severity of the storm was what it was, that the damage was what it was, and that the help was going to be slow in coming. And so we keep hearing stories about people doing whatever they needed to do to survive despite the conditions.
And Tanzina, you're down there as the president has been tweeting about the death toll on the island. And I'm very curious to hear how Puerto Ricans on the island feel about the president's comments.
I mean, I think that when we think about the president's tweets, to be specific, there's 2,975 deaths that were recorded in the latest study about the death toll after Hurricane Maria. The death toll and the deaths of Puerto Ricans does weigh heavy here. One thing I will say that people are not as obsessed over is the president himself. He'll come up in conversation, but there is an obsession over every single presidential slight, every single presidential tweet. And before we left, I talked to Frances Negron Muntaner, and she's a Puerto Rican filmmaker, writer, and scholar, and also a professor at Columbia University's Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. And she helped us understand why getting these numbers with the death toll is so important.
It's an affirmation and a demand for recognition that there was human beings that lost their lives as a result of Maria. But also is that the number itself, whether it's a small number or a big number, becomes a sort of representation of the scale of loss. It raises the question of not only that there was a lot of loss and pain and suffering that went with that process, but also raises the question of who is responsible, who is to be held accountable.
And, you know, Sarah, I think one of the things whenever we talk about, and we'll get into this in the segment, but there is a lot of pain in that lack of recognition. And we're going to hear more from Frances throughout the week. But we decided for one of our first stops, we should go and really explore who has witnessed that death firsthand and who knew that these numbers were higher than what was being reported.
My name is Robert Molina. I'm the general manager of Arid Funeral Home in San Juan, Puerto Rico. I've been the general manager at the funeral home for the last 18 years.
But last year was different for Robert, and we walked around the Funeraria Arid to get a sense of what things were like during Maria.
This is warehouse area. This is where we carry some of the stock. So what
is
we
this
do
where
is,
you had the bodies when they were coming in?
This is the embalming room. There is a body cooler back there. And we were using this visitation room here also.
When I sat down with Robert, he said he knew right away the extent of the devastation that Maria had caused and that it exceeded what government officials were telling him.
Before Maria, in 2017, we were handling average 68 to 70 calls a month. That's how they identify in the industry. They call them calls. So that was our average. The month after Maria, it went up to 112.
Were you expecting or anticipating a lot of calls after Maria?
No, not that much.
What were people saying when they were calling?
Many people were very concerned to find a funeral home. That was one of their main concerns at that time. As a matter of fact, this guy called. It was around midnight, and he was looking for cremation services because his mom just passed. And we were the fourth funeral home that he called. And he didn't get an answer in the first three. And at one point, we were turning down families. We turned down probably 12 or 15 families because we were not able to handle any more volume because all the bodies started stacking up here. We were not getting permits to bury anymore because the government agencies were not working. You know, on one point we had 27 bodies here. And I said, gotta stop. Can't go. I don't have enough room for them. And at one point, there is a hospital in Bayamón. It's a very large hospital, Hospital San Pablo. Their morgue was full. So they already had bodies on the hallway. That's very dangerous at a hospital. You know, those bodies will start decomposing. Normally, naturally, it's going to happen. So they were going to have an epidemic there at the hospital. That wasn't the only hospital with that.
Now, were people clear on whether or not these bodies were a result of the storm or anything related to the storm? Was it, or do you guys not get into the how?
Let me tell you, the paper, which is the death certificate, read something, which was the medical causes, but the story behind it, we got that from the family. Because they walked in, we had the paper there, and it said, whatever conditions it were. But then the family said, well, you know, he was stuck at home for 2 or 3 days. He couldn't get to the hospital, or he couldn't get to his dialysis. So we had the story behind it, which was not on the paper.
And what were many of those stories?
Medication, that they couldn't get their medications. And I have my own story about that. My in-laws live with us. The day after the hurricane, my mother-in-law needed some medications. And I went to a pharmacy, and the pharmacy said, all we are taking is cash. She said, it's $600. So some people said that. Some people said that they got too late to the hospital. I had a good friend. He was 59 years old. 3 or 4 weeks before the hurricane, he felt ill. He went to the emergency room. He had high blood pressure for the first time he knew that. Before that, he didn't know that. So they said, listen, you need to get to a cardiologist and get treatment and all that. So he was stabilized at emergency room. He was released. He called a doctor and he made an appointment. The appointment was 3 weeks after the hurricane. Well, the hurricane came. The doctor didn't open his office. So he missed the appointment. 4 weeks after the hurricane, he was in the emergency room again. He had a massive heart attack and he passed. So his mama called me on my cell phone and said, Charlie's gone. I said, what? Is that death related to a hurricane? Yes, it is. If he was able to get to the doctor, to his appointment, most likely he would still be around.
I'm sure you have either seen or heard about the President of the United States and his comments about the bodies. He has suggested that there were not 3,000 deaths. Those deaths were not related to the hurricane, according to what the president is saying. And he says, you know, that this is also an attempt by the Democrats to smear him, et cetera, et cetera. You do this every day. Do you think it matters that the president acknowledge these deaths?
Yes.
Why?
Yes. Well, most of the Puerto Ricans feel proud about being U.S. citizens. So I guess that most feel that we are not being treated as equals. We are being put aside. We are the small island there, you know, full of Puerto Ricans. No, it's full of U.S. citizens. So when these things happen, it's more confusing for us. You know, if half of the island wants to be a state, but they feel they are being treated this way, well, do I really want to be there? Or would I like to be separated or excluded permanently because I don't feel they are treating me the right way? So
you deal in an industry that I was, you know, when we were walking in, I said, this is one job I could not do.
Right? That's what I thought. That's what I thought.
That's what you thought.
Yes. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I never visited funeral homes. And if a family member of my wife passed, I just dropped her at the door, and I said, I'll be back in 2 hours and pick you up. I never walked in a funeral home.
And here you are.
Yes. Now I don't walk into my house.
So, but seriously, like, I wonder, was there a point for you personally in the process where the sort of strength of the funeral director fell to the side a little bit, and it was a little bit overwhelming or maybe a little bit more emotional than you expected it to be?
Every passing is different. When you take care of a family, every family is different. But during the hurricane, most of them had more stress. And they passed that along. And families were trying to get in touch with the funeral home. They didn't even have a phone. So their only option was get in the car, get there. Some of them didn't have any gas. I guess that everything added up, and it really touched us emotionally. Even though we are used to it and we deal with it on a daily basis, it was different. It was really different. You know, and some people just, when they left, they said, take good care of mom, take good care of pop. For them, many of that people were still alive, and they were just leaving them at like a elderly home and take good care of them. And it was very different. It got emotional. It really did.
So if we are being honest about Maria and everything else, we know that, or at least we can anticipate more storms like this in the future. Are you prepared if this happens again?
Us, I feel more prepared. We did a lot of things that normally we didn't do, and we learned a lot. I think we really survived. The island, I don't know if you have heard about what's going on in the Mega Examiner, about the bodies they still have there in containers. Well, it's a year after, and they still have 60 or 70 bodies there, just in some containers in the outside of forensics. Don't you think they should have taken care of that already a year after? Are they ready? I don't think so. I don't think they are.
That was Robert Molina, the general manager of Funeraria Arid in San Juan. We reached out to the medical examiner's office in Puerto Rico for comment regarding the bodies that remained since the storm, but we have not yet heard back.
Thanks, Tanzina, for that report, and good luck on the ground.
Thank you, Sarah.
Residents across the Carolinas continue to face flooding from intense rains and winds. Originally a hurricane, Florence has now been downgraded to a tropical depression, but the damage is still severe. At least 17 deaths occurred along Florence's path, and thousands are currently in shelters waiting out the storm.
We've got over 3,100 North Carolina National Guardsmen mobilized and working state relief operations right now.
Colonel Wes Morrison is the Chief of Army Operations for the North Carolina National Guard.
The situation is changing, especially with the roads right now, because even though the storm has generally passed, though we're experiencing a lot of spinoff thunderstorms, we have a lot of concerns as the next 3 days come along, as all those rains flow into our river systems and start to swell and overflow their banks. So our North Carolina National Guard citizens, soldiers stand ready. In some cases, their families are impacted by the storm, but they're like a lot of first responders. They're out there doing their duty. And we can't be more proud of them and to be associated with them.
And with us now is Will Michaels, a daily news producer for WUNC in Chapel Hill. Will, thanks for coming on.
Hi, Sarah.
And Will, give us an update. How are things looking on the ground where you are?
Well, the colonel really hit it on the head. The rain is just now stopping for many of us in North Carolina. And to give you an idea, it's been going on since probably Thursday. So it's several days worth of rainfall. And we're not talking about a little bit of drizzle. It's heavy rainfall 24 hours a day for several days. And the main concern now is watching where we have flash flood warnings. And we have, I mean, there are too many for me to go through individually. But suffice it to say, from central to eastern North Carolina, there are flash flood warnings continuing. And over the next few days, we're keeping our eyes on the major rivers in North Carolina because they are expected to crest tomorrow, about Tuesday morning. So, and that could happen in record levels in many places.
And Wilmington in North Carolina, a city with a population of 120,000, has been cut off because of flooding. You cannot access it by road. What's happening there, Will?
Right. So the I-40, which is the main artery into Wilmington, is closed because the roads are simply impassable. Other main roads into Wilmington to the west and east are cut off, which makes it very treacherous for people who might still be there to get out. Now, we do know that, again, the rain has stopped in Wilmington, so that's the good news. The Cape Fear River in Wilmington still hasn't crested. That's the bad news. And right now, we're not sure exactly how many people are still in Wilmington. We do know that hundreds of people have been rescued by swift water boats in places like New Bern. And New Bern, for instance, is at the mouth of two different rivers. And so it has the water coming in from central North Carolina down to the east. And it also has the storm surge that came up during Hurricane Florence over the weekend. It has already seen major flooding, and it could see more as time goes by.
And nearly 15,000 people are staying in shelters in North Carolina. Over the weekend, more evacuations were ordered in cities, including Fayetteville, which is one of the state's biggest cities. Did people follow those evacuation orders?
Largely, from our reporting, yes, they did. And that was within a mile of the Cape Fear River in Fayetteville. So many of them went to friends or family who were simply a mile or two away and just not in flood-prone areas. Some did come to further inland to some of the major shelters in places like Chapel Hill and Winston-Salem. But yes, largely from what we understand, people did heed those evacuation warnings, which is really good news today.
All right. Will Michaels is a daily news producer for WUNC. Will, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
As Florence was making its way through the Carolinas across the globe, another severe storm made landfall in Asia. Typhoon Mangkhut worked its way through the Philippines and Hong Kong before touching down in southern China on Sunday. Officials reported more than 60 dead in the Philippines, with dozens more missing, possibly buried under landslides caused by the typhoon. And at least two deaths were reported in Hong Kong. Lindsay Billing is a freelance reporter currently in the northern Philippines, which was directly hit by the storm.
You could say that the effects are mostly agricultural to the crops and also to the homes. There's been a lot of devastation in the coastal towns to people's homes, and just buildings and cities have just been completely wiped out. So there's a lot of work to be done on rebuilding and a lot of work to be done from aid organizations with housing these people in the interim.
And I know that landslides have been a big problem. What do the current rescue efforts look like in the areas affected by landslides? How are they being coordinated?
So right now yesterday there was the landslide with the miners, and there are a lot of people on the ground, but journalists on the scene have been saying that the rescue efforts, people are digging out the victims with their hands just because they're racing time right now.
Wow. And you said that the areas most directly hit by Mangkhut are agricultural centers. Do you have a sense of what the economic impact could be following the storm?
Yes. Well, one farmer told me yesterday that he has lost 70% of his crop to the typhoon. In these areas, people are reliant on agriculture. It's corn and rice and grain, and the harvest, a lot of people did manage to harvest before the typhoon, but those who didn't have just lost enormous amounts of their crops. So, you know, the effects economically are going to put a, you know, they're pretty huge right now.
And it appears that the death toll from Mangkhut in the Philippines will be relatively low compared to Typhoon Haiyan in 2013, which killed at least 6,300 people. What did the country do to prevent a disaster of that magnitude from happening again?
So a lot of people have credited the government on their efforts to alert people with evacuation centers and drills prior to the typhoon. And basically, I think that the Philippines was more prepared on this occasion. And, you know, the Philippines isn't averse to typhoons. We have as many as 20 a year. But the death toll was a lot lower due to these evacuations, and people really took them seriously this time. So the government was more organized and had more resources and systems in place to be prepared. more money and time was spent on drills before the typhoon hit, and Typhoon Mangkhut was on path to hit nearly 5 million people, but I think that the preparations and the evacuations really paid off on this occasion.
And looking ahead, does it seem like the government has a plan for recovery efforts in the wake of Typhoon Mangkhut?
Yeah, so right now there are INGOs that have come up to the affected areas in northern Philippines to assess the damage and work out where is best to place their efforts in terms of food distribution and shelter kits and aid. What I'm hearing from the residents in these areas that have been badly affected is that they need shelter and building materials most, and of course, financial support. I know that World Vision, CRS, Relief International, CARE, and of course, the Red Cross are in the area right now assessing the damage. And after they've assessed the damage, they'll put together what they need to move forward in the coming days. Right now, aid hasn't reached Apari or Bagao, and people are waiting for it, essentially.
All right, Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Lindsay Villing is a freelance reporter based in the Philippines.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, sitting in for Tanzina Vega while she's in Puerto Rico. Turning now to the world of higher ed and how colleges and universities in the United States choose who gets in. For decades, the Supreme Court has upheld that colleges can use race as one factor in deciding who to admit, with the aim of ensuring a diverse student body. What do you think? Should race be a factor? And how much does diversity matter on campus?
Hi, this is Devin from Long Island, New York. I believe race should definitely not be a factor. It further divides the admission to college. And I think the only thing that truly matters is your grades.
This is Daniel Lockhart from Albany, Oregon. I don't think race should be a factor in college admissions. I do believe diversity should be welcomed by everyone, but students should not be chosen simply to admit enough students of a certain group.
This is Catherine in Dallas, Texas. Race should not be a factor in college admission unless you think that certain people are incapable of qualifying without special consideration. Racial and gender diversity will take care of themselves when all people are judged strictly by the same criteria, regardless of gender or race.
When it comes to higher ed, it seems that for many of us, it's yes to diversity, but no to affirmative action, no to considering race in college admissions. A new poll by our partner station, WGBH, finds just that. Nearly 3 in 4 Americans disagree with the Supreme Court on its ruling to uphold affirmative action. And yet the majority still say they value diversity on college campuses. So why the disconnect? Kirk Carapeza is managing editor of our partner WGBH's Higher Education Desk. He reported on these results, and he's here to talk through it with us. Hi, Kirk.
Hey, Sarah.
And here, too, is Natasha Wariku, Associate Professor of Education at Harvard University and author of The Diversity Bargain and Other Dilemmas of Race, Admissions, and Meritocracy at Elite Universities. Hi, Natasha.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Kirk, let's start with you. Explain for us exactly what the poll found in terms of the public's view of race-conscious college admissions.
Sarah, the poll found opposition to the consideration of race in admissions, but a lot of support for racial diversity on college campuses. Only 24% of those we surveyed said they agree with the court's ruling on affirmative action, and nearly 72% said they disagree that colleges should be able to consider race as one factor in deciding which students to admit. At the same time, only 27% say admission decisions should be based solely on grades and exams. So there is this support for the quote-unquote holistic approach to admissions, considering a number of factors like leadership and athleticism, and you know whether you overcame hardships like poverty or health problems. 70% say admissions decisions should be based on a variety of factors. What's interesting to me is that our poll also finds that a large majority of whites and non-whites agree colleges should not take race into account when making admissions decisions. 72% of both groups disagree with the Supreme Court's rulings.
So people of color also don't think that race should be considered in college admissions. Natasha, do these findings surprise you? What do you make of them?
I think that one of the things to keep in mind is that polls about how people think about affirmative action or race-based considerations are very subject to how the question is asked. So in this case, you know, asking about do you agree with the Supreme Court ruling? We don't know if students are thinking more broadly about should universities be subject to the Supreme Court. We don't know if it's because they were not given a rationale. So I'll just give you another piece of data that I saw from 2017, just a year ago, where Americans were asked in general, this is a Pew poll, in general, do you think affirmative action programs designed to increase the number of Black and minority students on college campuses are a good thing or a bad thing? And in this wording of the question, 71% of Americans said that it was a good thing, and just 22% said it was a bad thing. So there's almost a flipping. So I don't quite know what to make of it or how much it's considered. And, you know, then it brings up these anxieties about is race being considered more than academics, which it never is. And that's when those anxieties kind of get stoked a little bit.
And Kirk, as part of your reporting on this topic, you spoke with a lot of Americans about these issues. Can you tell us some of what you heard?
Sure. We spent a lot of time on campus and spoke with college-age students. I also called back a number of the respondents. And as Natasha said, there is a lot of confusion here. I think some people heard race conscious or the consideration of race as race-based, as if it's a determinative factor, which the Supreme Court has ruled it cannot be. It's just one factor of many. But there were some Americans who, when I followed up, I'd say, okay, if we shouldn't consider race, if colleges should not consider race, how should they achieve diversity? And a lot of Americans pause at that point. They don't know how schools like Harvard should achieve the level of diversity that they've achieved without considering race. I spoke with one legal scholar, and he compared it to Americans loving their hot dogs but not wanting to know how the hot dog is made.
Natasha, why don't more Americans believe that race-based admissions are the answer?
Well, I think that there's if we think about why race-based admissions, and you said to the answer, right? And to me, that raises the question of the answer to what, right? So is it the answer to a diverse learning environment in which everyone benefits? And we know that to be a well-educated American today, we need to be exposed to a lot of different perspectives. That's an answer to that question. Is it the answer to racial inequality and the ongoing impact of racial injustice, you know, historically and in the contemporary period? And is it the answer to that? And I would argue that part of the problem is that, we don't teach children about racial inequality and the historical roots of racial inequality in the United States and, 20th century social policies that have affected African Americans in particular, issues of legal status and these kinds of things that affect the opportunities of Americans, even within the same social class. That lack of understanding of how racial inequality continues to affect the lives of Americans is in part why there's so much ambivalence about race.
Natasha Wariku is an associate professor of education at Harvard University. Thanks, Natasha.
Thank you for having me.
Kirk Carapeza is managing editor of our partner WGBH's Higher Education Desk. Thanks, Kirk.
Thank you, Sarah.
When you hear that someone was convicted for drug conspiracy, what comes to mind? Maybe the image of a cash-loaded drug lord or a big-time dealer prone to violence. But inside America's prisons, the people serving time for drug conspiracy crimes are often anything but. Take 59-year-old Craig Cecil.
I believe this with all of my heart, that someone with power, all they have to do is look at my dad's case and say, this is ridiculous.
That is Lauren Cecil. Her father, Craig, was a truck repairman sentenced to life in prison for fixing trucks used by Mexican drug traffickers for marijuana. Craig is one of an estimated dozens of people serving life sentences for marijuana conspiracy, and one of many more thousands serving lengthy or life sentences for nonviolent drug crimes. But in 2014, incarcerated people like Craig learned that they had a chance at freedom. President Obama had launched a clemency initiative for people just like him.
It was like a party, you know, all these people finally were getting out towards the end, and it was just like a celebration, you know, but they weren't calling my dad's name, you know, and it was like, okay, well, maybe at the end, maybe at the end. And every list that came out, I just dug my eyes, you know, deep into it. I'm like, it's got to be in here. I must be missing it. And every time it wasn't there.
While more than 1,700 people did get their sentences commuted or reduced, thousands more prisoners, like Craig, were denied or never even had their case reviewed, even though they met Obama's criteria for clemency.
He set out 6 criteria for people. And, you know, basically they were that you didn't commit a violent offense, you didn't have any violence in your background, you had a good record while incarcerated, you didn't have significant criminal history, and if you had been sentenced today, you would have received a different lower sentence.
Rachel Barco is a professor at New York University Law School, and I asked her to explain the charges that land people like Craig behind bars for life.
Our drug laws treat, you know, the kingpin the same as the courier in the sense that they're all going to be responsible for the same quantity of drugs. So you do see a lot of people in federal prison who served low-level roles in these conspiracies getting hit with tremendously long sentences because, by and large, sentences in the federal system are based on the amount of drugs involved. So when you have these really large quantities of drugs, you know, everybody involved is going to get hit with those very high sentences that are attached to the large quantities. So, you know, you see the girlfriend or the wife that helps out in some small way with the conspiracy, you know, is going to be treated just like the partner that, you know, she was helping.
What would you say was the biggest flaw of Obama's clemency project?
So I would say the number one flaw with the clemency project and just with federal clemency generally, you know, today and even before President Obama took office, is that the Department of Justice handles clemency petitions. And so it's the same agency that prosecuted all these cases. So we have this very strange setup where we ask the same prosecutors who brought the case and thought the sentence made sense to reevaluate it and say, hey, does it make sense? So it's just inevitable and asking an awful lot of human nature to reevaluate those objectively. It's just inevitable that they're going to say no and deny them in the vast majority of these cases, which they did. Even after the president had said, you know, I really want to do this, you were still seeing prosecutors around the country saying, nope, you know, we don't think this is a good case, and saying, you know, deny, deny, deny.
So part of the problem was that prosecutors didn't want to acknowledge that their original sentences were maybe too harsh or wrong, and the other was just red tape.
Yes, I think that's right.
Do you know how many people were denied who did meet the criteria?
We have an estimate from the Sentencing Commission, which issued a report on the program. So they interpreted all the criteria very strictly. So, you know, really giving the benefit of the doubt to the government on this one. And they estimated that, you know, there were a little fewer than 2,700 people who met the criteria. And of those, 92 of them received clemency. So about 3.4% got it, you know, which means more than 96% were denied. I do think it's a significant flaw to leave behind all the people who squarely met the criteria, got their hopes up, you know, really their families, their loved ones. People thought, oh, this is finally going to be the chance we're going to get some justice. To have all those people denied is really a tragedy.
And do you know, were there any commutation petitions granted for people who did not meet the criteria?
Yeah, so that same report tried to estimate of the people who got the grants, how many of them met the criteria. And again, you know, interpreting them quite strictly, roughly 5.1% of the people who got it met it.
So, Rachel, what was the real criteria to qualify? Did it come down to luck?
You know, it sure looks like it came down to some luck of the draw. Did your lawyer file your petition on time? Did you get a prosecutor who insisted on saying no, don't grant this? Did you just catch them on a good day to say, Grant, did they think you did something else, even if it's not in your record? You know, we don't really know exactly because the department doesn't have to give any reasons when they deny a petition. And then many people just never got an answer at all. They didn't get a grant or a deny. You know, there's almost 8,000 people who fell into that boat, too.
Do you have thoughts on what clemency will look like under Trump compared to Obama?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, we could make some guesses based on what he's done so far. You know, unfortunately, you see that return to who do you know, who are you connected to, where you see, you know, that then it ends up being skewed toward people who have political connections to the president.
So who did you mean when you said that the people who get clemency now are people who are well connected? Give me some examples of who you're talking about.
Well, you know, that would be situations like Sheriff Joe, Dinesh D'Souza, people who fit into that box of being the president's supporters and allies who come to his attention for that reason, as opposed to, you know, the many thousands of people anonymous to the president who are serving out these very long sentences for drugs and other offenses.
Rachel Barco, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Rachel Barco is a professor of law at NYU Law School. Craig has been in prison more than half of his 30-year-old daughter's life.
He has been in prison for 16 years for a conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute marijuana, and he has a life sentence without the possibility of parole.
But Lauren Cecil's memories of time with her dad are vivid.
My dad was a pilot with his own plane. So when my parents were married, we would fly to Disney, and then even after they got divorced, you know, you have like a split life. And he'd be like, yeah, let's go visit my friends, you know, in this other state and go have dinner with them. And we would just go to the plane and fly there and, you know, pull up in their field and go to dinner and fly home and then have him drive us home and go to school the next day. When I tell people, they're like, that's not real. I'm like, no, like, I actually did that with my dad.
Lauren told me that she doesn't feel her father's punishment even comes close to fitting his crime.
So his job was to fix trucks in general. I mean, he fixed everything. He was like the dad, you know. He would repair the trucks that had ripped out portions that had marijuana transporting from Mexico. So he just repaired the trucks. He literally never saw anything, but he got paid well. And I have letters. He's like, it was for like your college. It was all for you, like me and my brother, you know. So it's just hard.
Craig is one of dozens of people serving life sentences for marijuana charges and one of thousands of people with lengthy sentences for all kinds of nonviolent drug crimes. Craig and thousands of others tried to have their sentences commuted under Obama's clemency initiative that began in 2014. His daughter Lauren remembers when the program was first announced.
People started reaching out to me and said, your dad qualifies for every single one of the criteria that they're looking for. Let's go for this. And it was just extreme chaos. And it was just like, for once, there was hope.
So everyone said that he was a good candidate for this. Tell us a little bit about what made him a good candidate. How did you know he would qualify for this program?
So you had to have no prior convictions because there's a three-strike law. You have to be within that. And he was on good conduct, which means you don't get into fights, you don't cause trouble, any of that. He has none. And he works full-time. He has since he's started.
There what
was
does
like
he work
five
as?
Other things. So he works in a factory for Unicor. He does various things. I remember one of his jobs, he's head of sewing. So they're in this factory all day and they have to sew for the Marines jackets for pregnant women. And they've also had disaster relief blankets. And he does this all day, every day for like less than a dollar an hour.
And so when you found out about this opportunity that your dad had the chance to get his sentence reduced to maybe not spend the rest of his life in prison for a marijuana offense, how did that make you feel?
Even you saying it just like gives me butterflies. I've explained, you know, to people what it's like to not have my dad and where he is. And it's kind of like as if he died because I'd never get to see him again in the way that I want to or the way that I should. When I heard that and had the opportunity, it was like the first time I had this like glittering feeling inside that, oh my God, like, I might be able to go to, like, dinner with my dad. You know, like, it sounds so simple. I might be able to go walk down the street with him. I might be able to walk anywhere with him. Man, I would do literally anything to go get ice cream with him. Like, anything.
So what happened with your dad's application?
So these lists started coming out of people that were getting out, and there were no marijuana lifers. And so we just didn't stop. We kept going. I went to D.C. and was outside the White House with signs. And so his application, I think just things got crazy, and they were focused on more of a lot of crack cases. And I think that his just was overlooked and time ran out.
So did you ever get any kind of explanation?
Absolutely not.
Do you think that there were problems with Obama's initiative?
Oh, absolutely. I know specifically the lawyer that was my dad's just wasn't there and wasn't really helping, because Obama, during the Clemency Project, they were all given lawyers to help, but they were all like pro bono. So I just don't think that they helped the way that they could. And I think that the focus was on this sort of mass incarceration for crack. And I think the obvious is marijuana, and it should just be a no-brainer. There are so many people incarcerated for, you know, absurd amounts of time for their cases that just, it doesn't just, the punishment doesn't fit the crime. And I think there was just so many that it just got overwhelming.
You talked about wanting to walk with your dad down the street or to go get ice cream. And I think you've been waiting for your dad to get out to walk you down the aisle as well, right?
As silly as that sounds, yes. My boyfriend and I have been together 12 years. I'm probably the last of my friends, especially that have been in a relationship, that aren't married and now have kids. And people say, you know, when are you going to get married? And I'm like, there is a very silly little girl inside of me that wants my dad to walk me down, as untraditional as I am. But even I went to a wedding about a week ago, and you know, there's a father-daughter dance, and I feel this, like, lump in my stomach my whole life. I'm just like, I will never have that. Even in movies and everything, I just can't even watch it. I don't know. I don't feel like it would be the same if he wasn't there.
Do you think it'll happen?
I hope with all my heart. And if not, I'm going to Vegas, the drive-thru. So nobody will walk me down. I'll go in the car.
Lauren Cecil, thank you so much for sharing your family story with us.
Thank you for having me. Oh my gosh, this means so much.
Lauren Cecil is the daughter of Craig Cecil, who is serving life in prison on marijuana conspiracy charges. He applied to have his sentence commuted by President Obama, but was denied, even though he met the criteria. With so many cases like Craig Cecil's, some states are now taking things into their own hands.
California voters legalized marijuana in 2016, and as part of that ballot measure, they actually allowed past marijuana convictions to be either reduced from felonies to misdemeanors or for misdemeanors to be dismissed completely.
That's Marisa Lagos, political reporter for KQED in San Francisco.
But most prosecutors haven't moved to do that automatically, and experts say that folks with these kinds of convictions may not know or have the resources to pursue these expungements. So in San Francisco, the district attorney, George Gascon, actually decided earlier this year that he would do it automatically. Other prosecutors haven't followed suit, and so an assemblyman actually introduced a bill this year that was passed and now sits on Governor Jerry Brown's desk. The Drug Policy Alliance says that there are probably about 500,000 people who have these sorts of felonies and misdemeanors just from the years of 2016 to 2015. But as of last year, only 5,000 people had actively gone to court.
What do you think? Should people, particularly those in states where recreational marijuana is legal, be able to clear their marijuana convictions? Tweet us at The Takeaway or join the conversation on our Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Sarah Gonzalez in for Tanzina Vega while she's reporting in Puerto Rico this week. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway's coverage of Puerto Rico is supported in part by the Puerto Rico Relief and Rebuilding Fund of the Partnership for New York City. Funder of Para la Naturaleza, a leader in environmental conservation and historic preservation in Puerto Rico for over 50 years. Info at pln.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.